To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Welcome, everyone, to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction. What's up, everybody? You know that song. You know this voice. It's your boy, Rook. Joining me is Mr. Sleepy himself. It's Dawn Moore.
That's right. I just got up.
And she's back. Everybody, welcome again. Bijenaga.
Hey, how's it going? My name is Bijenaga.
So nice to have you back again. This is a conversation we had we were talking about inviting you back, and you said that somehow Wonder Woman came up. I don't remember exactly. And you said you were a big fan, that you had lots to talk about. So this episode, we're talking about the actual creator of Wonder Woman, William Marston. Bijen, there's something special about Marston for you. You really enjoy his work.
Yeah, there is something really unique about his work, because he was living on the front lines of getting things like kinks and polyamory and bisexuality to be understood and accepted by the public. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he had some real skin in the game. He was really active in lots of activism. And his greatest accomplishment in his academic work was a 1928 book called The Emotions of Normal People, in which he vigorously defended the idea that being kinky and being gay and being queer and being trans and all of these things were totally normal, and that they were absolutely, that they should be accepted by society at large. So the idea that he could then sit down and write a comic about a woman who is a superhero and have that be apolitical is impossible. The book was 100% a work of his true belief in the idea that women were going to be part of the future. He said literally that he wanted it to be an educational book to teach boys how to accept feminine leadership. Leadership that was distinct and different from the style that men would take. So that's why he created two very strong characters in Steve Trevor, who is everything a man should be, and Diana Prince, who is everything a woman should be. And he doesn't compromise Steve Trevor's masculinity. He doesn't compromise Diana's femininity. He shows a working relationship of equals who both have something very important to bring to the table. For Steve, it's his worldliness, and for Diana, it's her powers. And they mesh in a way that is instructive. It's like the original purpose of theater and drama, which was to teach us how to live our lives, you know. The first cave paintings were recordings of battles between humans and other animals. And that was meant to show that the methods we use to survive those encounters. So he wanted to create something, and even drawing directly from Greek mythology, he wanted to create something that was truly mythological in its scope and scale and purpose.
What year did he write that book when it came out?
Oh, I'm sorry. I think something got said, but I didn't get any...
Year was that?
The book.
What year was the comic?
The book that he wrote, yeah.
Oh, no, the book. The book about...
Yeah, so it's very interesting. The first comic was 1942, and that was the first time that people had heard of Charles Moulton, which was his pen name, as a comics writer. But it wasn't the first time William Moulton Marston had written fiction. He had actually written fiction all throughout high school and college, and in 1913, he sold his first script, which was called The Thief, to filmmaker Alice Guy Blaché. And she directed the film in 1913. That was actually one of the first major motion pictures that was narrative fiction. So he was one of the first screenwriters to write a modern script as we understand it today.
Wow.
So he was really big into fiction earlier on in his life, and he really understood it as a way to access the human psyche and communicate ideas about psychology. So he had written for his high school newspaper. He'd written fiction in there, in the college newspaper. And then The Thief was his first major motion picture. So in 1942, actually, it was the year before, he had actually done a piece for a magazine. And in the magazine, he talked about his aspirations for comics. And it was because of that a comic publisher approached him to be the head of educational materials at the comic publisher. And that was Sensation Comics. So his idea was to create this educational material, not in necessarily instructing on logical thinking, mathematics, science, but instructional and in educational on how to accept femininity into modern society. So that was his idea, and that's where Wonder Woman came from in 1942. And it was a ripe moment, because we had just entered the war on both fronts, and the women workforce was now becoming much more important to our ability to continue to wage war. So right. The United States was in a position where that we were seeing women in more positions of power and authority all the time. And so that moment in 1942 was just a golden moment for this comic to come out.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost a perfect timing, really. Wonder Woman has stood up as, and I actually have hanging somewhere in this room, a design of Wonder Woman in like the Rosie the Riveter stance. I mean, it's
exactly.
She's such an empowering character, but a lot of people attribute the fact that he was able to create such a empowering female character to the women in his life.
Absolutely. So one of the things that a lot of people know that know anything about William Moulton Marston is that he was in a polyamorous triad with two other women, and that those women were in love with each other as well. So they were Elizabeth Holloway Marston, who was his legal wife, the first one he married. She actually helped him develop the systolic blood pressure a measurement device that he would use as someone else would invent. It was John Augustus Larson who invented the modern polygraph, but Elizabeth Holloway and William Moulton Marston invented the systolic pressure meter, and so they worked together on that, and it was them working together and collaborating where they became enamored with each other and fell in love. And to be clear, Marston also, in his lifetime, denounced the polygraph as genuinely being a lie detector. He said that the only thing that it could accurately detect was stress. And so they had invented a stress detector, and that people often became stressed when they were lying, but that wasn't a one-to-one correlation.
Yeah, I mean, anybody that gets pressure
but they didn't. But the systolic blood pressure test, yeah. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, just having the light in your face and just being told that you're in that position can completely change everything.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, it was with Elizabeth Holloway, who became Elizabeth Holloway Marston, that he invented that. And she was an attorney and a psychologist, and she actually served as an editor for Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yes.
So she was in his eyes a real Wonder Woman. And then it was when he came around in 1928, when he started writing the book The Emotions of Normal People, that he met Mary Olive Byrne, who was known professionally as Olive Richards. And she went by Olive. So Olive was a Tufts University physician, and she had actually taken a lot of information about queer people and kinky people in the world, and she had turned that into sets of data that he was then going to use in his book to disseminate that information. So they worked very closely on not only getting that data into a book, but also interpreting it and making sure that their interpretation was backed up by science. And so she was actually known for having a very androgynous appearance on the streets, but she was physically the model for Wonder Woman with the dark hair, dark eyes, but very light complexion, almost ruddy. That was very much Olive. They eventually had a private marriage ceremony, all William, Elizabeth, and Olive, in which Olive was given, instead of a wedding ring, she was given two wideband bracelets to show her connection and submission to the Marstons.
And that's and where the bracelets come from.
Exactly, yes. It was a nod to Olive, because to William and Elizabeth, you know, to William's first Wonder Woman was Elizabeth, and then to Elizabeth, Olive was the Wonder Woman. So he really, when he was writing these characters, it was absolutely about the women in his life. You know, he adored these women, and he thought so highly of them as people, as academics, as equals, that he wanted to show the world. He basically wanted to shout it from the rooftops, and the easiest way to do that in the 1942 was in the form of a comic book.
Yeah. Now, I'm curious, because his book, The Emotions of Normal People, it really didn't catch on. Like, it was pretty much dismissed. But he kept yeah. going, and he really truly believed in everything he said there. And if we look at the world now,
yep.
we see the things he said in this book are out there for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, it's fascinating to think that in the 20s, someone was thinking this way. And, you know, we get those people out there today that are like, oh, back in my day, this was never. Well, guess what? In 1920. Right.
Exactly.
He's fascinating, you know, psychology, inventing, and then creates one of the greatest comic book characters, hands down the greatest female comic book character ever. How do you think he would look at the way we present Wonder Woman today?
Oh, that's a very complicated question. So
I know, that's why I wanted to ask it.
Yeah. I think that he would be very happy with the theatrical films, and he would be very happy with the television series, the 1970s television series. I also think that he'd have a lot of great things to say about many of the comics which have been happened to be written by women or by men who had minds like his. I think that in particular he would be absolutely furious about the way Frank Miller has written the character.
Yes.
I think that would be probably his least favorite. It to be as charitable as possible, his least favorite interpretation of the character ever.
Yeah.
I don't think he would have a single nice thing to say about Frank Miller's depictions. But I think that Patty Jenkins, as a director, has had much more success in capturing his original intentions with the character.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing with the DC movies. So many of them were so bad, and Wonder Woman came out and it was like, wow, holy cow. Reset, start the franchise from here.
Yeah.
Focus on her.
It was.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I wish they would have done that, but.
You know, one thing you're talking about with Marston, I've been reading a book, The Secret History of Wonder Woman.
Wonderful book.
Yeah, it is wonderful. And one of the things they were talking about in it, which I guess I'm not surprised, but I know, was what was influencing most of these people, Marston, Holloway, and was the suffragette movement. Women could not vote. And they were pushing that. You know, they finally did get the vote. It wasn't easy. Not all the states were aligned into it. And it just kept going from there. But women weren't supposed to be educated in college. Marston went to Harvard. Holloway wasn't allowed. You know, she went to another college over there. And everything you're reading about, it starts making a lot more sense of Marston really believed that women were a higher form of living creatures than men were. And
he's not wrong.
Yeah, he was almost bordering on misandry. He was really very fervent on the idea that women were not just equals, but he really truly believed that they were superior.
Yes.
And at the same time, he believed in trans rights. He argued about trans men, women, and non-binary people in the emotions of normal people. He just described these things using completely different terms, but that's what he was describing.
Yes. Yeah, and that's really amazing considering the time. The world I saw, I grew up in the 60s. And that's extremely forward thinking for even then, even now, honestly. That was amazing. One thing they talk about in the book quite a bit was everything was experiments. He always had experiments going on. That's again, the lie detector test. The one thing they had two other people running the tests, and they weren't that accurate. When he was doing it, it was 44% out of 45. And his comment was, I should be doing all of them. Well, honestly, to me, that's a red flag right there that one person's controlling it. You know, like, well, wait, hold on. I see the logic to it, but there was... Anyway, when something wouldn't work, you know, when Harvard dropped some of that program and the police department wouldn't take it, he moved on to the next thing. I find that really fascinating.
Yeah. He was a very forward-thinking guy. And in a very literal sense, like, he was always thinking about how to push things forward, how to move things forward. And if something wasn't going to stick, if something wasn't going to really make its mark, he was willing to move on to the next thing. That's the same thing with his book, moving from his book to the comics. He tried to attack the intellects of reasonable people and got nowhere. So he looked around and he said, what is changing these people's minds before they even come to me in my book? It's their childhoods, right? Mm-hmm. So he was able to improvise, he was able to adapt, and he said, let me get them while they're young, you know, let me try to implant these ideas in their minds while they're still reasonable before they become unreasonable adults.
So now his ideas and his thought process when he created Wonder Woman, how much of that was he able to write into his storylines?
Yeah, so there was definitely a huge issue with censorship. He definitely wanted everything to be queerer than it actually ended up being. Both of his wives were bisexual. They were in love with each other as well. Something that most people don't appreciate is that he died a half a century before they did, and they spent the rest of their lives together.
Yep.
And so they were truly, truly, genuinely in love with each other, and that was part of his admiration for them, was their ability to love each other as well. So he wanted so badly to add these other elements to his comic, and was not able to in the way that he wanted to, because it would never have gone to press. There was, like, if he had asked Harry G. Peter to paint a scene where Wonder Woman kisses a woman and then kisses Steve Trevor, right, then that print would have been burned to pieces before it was ever sent to a press.
Yeah.
So there was definitely a lot of censorship in his time, so he had to be subversive in the way of, like, a truly great artist. People who can talk about one thing while showing you something completely different. Like Stan Lee talking about race and gender and sexuality with the X-Men. Or George Lucas talking about capitalism and communism with Star Wars. you know, so he had to hide Devo. I mean, let's even get into music. Devo hiding their message about anti-consumerism and anti-capitalism in pop punk music, you know, like, yeah. And truly the greats of every genre have been forced by their era to take their most progressive values and ideas and embed them in something that seems harmless. So he wasn't able to create as progressive a product as he wanted. So he created as subversive a product as he could.
When did you start reading Wonder Woman comics? When did you discover?
Oh, definitely I started to read right at the tail end of 3 years old and right up at the beginning of four. And they would take us to the library, the King County Library in White Center. It was the White Center branch of the King County Library. And we would be, they had these sections, and it would go from the most colorful kids' books on one end all the way to like anatomy textbooks and like old periodicals on the left side. And in the middle were these big, thick reprints of old comics. And so it was not only classic Marston Wonders Woman, but it was also Stan Lee and Steve Ditko Spider-Man. It was 80s X-Men. There was even Ninja Turtles, like the original like 80s Ninja Turtles comics, the indie comics reprinted. They were all in black and white. So they'd have these big thick volumes, no color, and on this yellow pulpy paper. Yeah. And I would take one of these things home and I would read it, and I would actually take it into the bathroom with me, and I would get so into the book that my feet would fall asleep, and then I'd have to stumble my way out of the bathroom. Yeah. My big thick book. But I was just obsessed with comics as a kid. Yeah, absolutely.
When I was six, in comic books, they used to have in the DC comic books, they had an ad for Palisades Park, which I guess is an amusement park in California. Little half-page ad, Superman was holding a giant roller coaster, and they had a headshot of Wonder Woman. I didn't know who she was. And I had asked my dad, he explained to me, "Is Wonder Woman." I says, what is she? He goes, "She's like a lady Superman." Really? Well, I never saw any Wonder Woman comic books. And, you know, they had a Superman cartoon from Filmation, and then later they added Aquaman in the mid to late 60s. On that, they had the Teen Titans. They had a Green Lantern, Hawkman, Flash. That was my introduction to these characters. Wonder Woman wasn't a part of it. When I started saving comics, I started finding them. I was nine. This is in 1970. And Wonder Woman was wearing a white suit. She went by Diana Prince, and she lost her powers. They refer to that as the mod era. And I had some of those comics. I didn't buy them. My neighbor would read comics and give them to me. A couple of times, my mom bought me a 3-pack of comics. They used to, at the grocery store, you could buy 3 comic books in one plastic pack. And I said, Wonder Woman, you know, one, it's a girl's comic. I'm not going to read it. But mom said, well, this is all they had.
Right.
Of course, I did read it, you know, but not so much fun. But DC would put out these reprint books. They were 100 pages. And everybody listening to the show knows those are my favorites when I was a kid. Again, my mom bought one. It was Adventure Comics. It was one I wouldn't touch, but it was all women. The cover had Supergirl flying. It had all the Mary the Girl of a Thousand gimmicks. It had Wonder Woman. The Wonder Woman story was fascinating because it was Villainy Inc. And I guess it was all her rogues gallery all teamed up together. And one thing I found strange about that was three of the women dressed as male characters. One was the Blue Snowman. One was, I think, Dr. Hypno. You know, she had a little, you know, had a turban, had a beard. I can't remember the other one. I think she was wearing a surgical outfit. But that's when I saw the Holiday Girls and Etta Candy, which I didn't really understand what that was. But I remember reading I remember reading the story, and again, by this time I'm 10 years old, and I was irritated my mom bought it, but I read it. Now, my mom did read comics as a kid, and she read my comics. My mom was a voracious reader. She read everything. If it was in the house or a friend of hers gave it, she would read it cover to cover. And but she didn't like to talk about them. She'd be terrible in a book club. She knew the material, but she read it, and that was it. But she read the Wonder Woman thing, you know, Villainy Inc., and I was asking her a lot of questions. She did answer them, but I found it surreal, but I loved it. And then I'd always read these. H.G. Peters, I think, is one of the most wonderful cartoonists. He had an awkwardness to his work.
Absolutely.
But it was like he was trying to draw images off of Greek vases, and they were just fantastic. Right. And but I read her origin story, and it freaked me out finding out that she was a lump of clay. I can't lie. And I thought, wait a minute, what? This character that I knew was a piece, a lump of clay. That one freaked me out. The other stuff that you talked about, I see it as an adult. I look back on it. Oh, I can see that. But I look at it as an eyes of a 9-10-year-old kid. And I found them wonderful. These weren't comics I would have bought when I was a kid because, I don't know why. When you're a kid, I guess if it's not male, you stay away from it. Like there's a phobia. Like, they're going to make fun of me. I shouldn't be reading this. But if somebody had it and you read it, well, actually, this is pretty cool.
I wanted to bring up Harry G. Peter because he's such a wonderful artist. Something that people don't talk a lot about is that he completely changed his art style to adapt to Wonder Woman.
Yes.
Because he was used to writing for or illustrating for magazines. So in magazines, he used the Gibson style, which is super hyper realistic. And you can use really thin lines because they're printing on this glossy paper with this, this nice inking machine. But when he went to work on a comic and he tried to do the same kind of art, it came out all blurry and messy because the printer wasn't able to handle his fine little lines.
Yeah.
So he had to change it to an Art Nouveau style. So the first couple of comics that he drew, it was him getting used to the new style. And you can see it in the action poses in particular, where he's still trying to get used to how to communicate motion with this new style. But once you get into issue about 4 or 5, he really starts to get starts to sink his teeth into it. And the motion of the action becomes much more clear and much more freestyle. It's very fun.
Yeah, it was fun. I always been told about this. Harry G. Peters was a lot older than most of the cartoonists. Most of the cartoonists were late teenagers and in their early 20s. He was 61 when he started drawing Wonder Woman. And he drew her for 17 years. And she was in Sensation Comics, and she got her own magazine. He didn't do the covers for 17 years, but he did them for quite a while, 12, 13 years. He also did the newspaper strip that ran for about a year. That's a lot of work. And I never seen any story that I didn't think it didn't look like he phoned it in. I mean, they were nice. One thing they were talking about, there's been some criticism to him because, it's Marston's creation. Everybody talks about Marston. You don't really hear Harry G. Peters. It's people like us that like comics and art that know about him. But some criticism is he was basically just a hired hand that did whatever Marston said. But I look at that as professional. If you get it, you do what's needed to be done. Some people can't do that. Also, he did come up with a lot of stuff. Her design, Marston just said, I want somebody that shows strength. I want a heroic character. I want her he basically, I remember he said he wanted to be as beautiful as Miss Fury, which is an old comic strip. He wanted to be as scandy clad as Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, one of my favorite comics. And he had a few issues about what he wanted to look patriotic, which he did. But the only, after Peters had done the design and brought it to Marston, the only thing Marston said was, "I don't like her shoes." So he had to change that, you know. But a lot of the characters in it, he either designed or created outright. And it absolutely, and I said this off mic when we were talking last time, as much as I love those stories, when I see those, all the women of stories, all that smell is perm solution, which grosses me out. When I was a kid, my grandmother was a hairdresser. I had to spend a lot of time in the beauty salon there that she had. I was a little kid, but just a bit much. So whenever I see all these ancient Greek hairstyles, all I think was all the chemicals it made to do that. And it's unpleasant to a four-year-old mind.
Well, let's take a quick break and do something that is pleasant for all minds.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
Joe Dimension can be found on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
And that's Do the Funky Lunar Microbe by Bijan Agha, a song about doing a little dance on the distant side of the moon.
You are literally a creator of all things.
I try to do all kinds of things. You know, I like making this music. I like making these comics. I like making games. Speaking of which, I've got a new comic coming out for all the listeners who don't already know. Cobra Olympus is a superhero who is trans, Muslim, and gay, and she is off to save the day. So Time Wars, The Adventures of Cobra Olympus is a comic that is on Kickstarter.com. The art was inspired by a lot of mid-century artists like Harry G. Peter, Jack Kirby, and Bill Everett. And the story is punchy. It's a nice 20 pages. It goes right through it, and the artwork is absolutely beautiful. I can't take credit for it. Otherwise, I wouldn't say something so nice about it. But all the credit goes to Swap Trap, my artist. He's over there in India. He's doing an amazing job. Everyone look him up at Swap Trap, SWAPTRAP. So we're doing that. $2 will get you a digital comic. $6 will get you a full comic, and then it keeps going up. Local comic shops, there is a retailer tier, so go check that out.
Awesome. So when it comes to Wonder Woman, at what point did each of you realize she had a connection to queer culture in your lives? What point did you all notice that?
Episode 361, when Bijan came on and told me.
I think it's sort of this queerdar thing, like where we can sort of sense each other, where I can I can see someone with a haircut and a dye job and a certain set of tattoos, and I can be like, you're one of us. So it was sort of this thing where before I even knew, that she had all this queerness to her, I could sort of feel it in the way I mean, you're just not going to find that many straight white cis dudes who are so eager to celebrate femininity. It happens, obviously, otherwise we wouldn't be sitting here talking about a comic that does exactly that, right? Yeah. So it obviously happens. But it's so hard and rare to find that it's usually first embraced by and steeped in queerness.
And that's amazing, because I had to probably be around 19 or 20 before I realized it. And I basically somebody had to just tell me. And of all places to be, I was at a fetish club. I hang out. At that time, I was hanging out at a lot of nightclubs, bars. I'd go to fetish nights and things like that. And I remember seeing someone that, everybody's in leather and latex and, really all dressed up for this event. And in walked someone in just a store-bought Wonder Woman outfit. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm like, well, how come they're letting her in? That's just a costume that they bought. That's not even And I said something to a friend of mine, and they looked at me and they were like, dude, seriously? You need to go back and reread Wonder Woman and see how many times she ties people up.
Or got tied up. I will say this, though. I was 10 years old, and Wichita Falls, Texas, the downtown theater, showed two Hercules movies, Hercules and Hercules Unchained with Steve Reeves. To this day, two of my favorite movies. And my cousin and I went to see it. That's all we talked about. We thought it was the greatest thing in the world. Anyway, I found them on DVD as I got older. And even in high school, they showed them on television. And a bunch of guys went to high school. Man, it's really good, isn't it? It's a good show. Well, anyway, I'm at work. I was talking to a good friend of mine who's a massive Wonder Woman fan. Big Star Trek fan. She's one of us. But when she found out I was watching those movies, she started laughing. Goes, they're so gay. What? And I mean, when I watch them, I'm watching them with the eyes of a 10-year-old kid. And, when you're 10, you want to hang out with other boys and do things with other boys. After she said I watched it, she says, yeah, they are. I couldn't argue with it. But I don't know. When you're a kid, you're not thinking of those kind of things. And Wonder Woman, she's one of those characters that if you don't see the connection, it's just a character you love. She kind of hit a universal stride in all things. I've always liked her. Yeah. They were showing her on repeats on FX back in the early 90s when my daughter was 3 years old. And when it came on, I never talked about her, and she kept, "Who is that?" And I said, "It's Wonder Woman." And she was fascinated, and every once in a while she'd ask when it was going to come on again. And I said, "Oh, it's going to come on in an hour." And she kept saying, "In the outfit?" And she would try to, you know, with her hands, design it. I said, "Yeah, in the outfit." She just thought she was the greatest. You know, she anything in Wonder Woman related, she would get. And I said, you know, that's a kid. But she kind of permeated society. Well, didn't kind of. She permeated society. Everybody knows Wonder Woman. And she's basically what anybody wants to see.
Yeah, that's really what I was talking about her being subversive, you know, is that she comes in the outside of her is it's almost like a sort of a really nice Trojan horse. The outside is friendly and charming and welcoming to everyone, and the inside is a gay dance club. So this sort of wonderful thing where I've talked to plenty of adult gay men who say that when they were young, they would watch the Wonder Woman TV show, and they would spin around in a little cape and they'd pretend to be Diana Prince, and she's not just it's because she's such a great exhibition of femininity that she is able to help people whose femininity is overlooked feel accepted and embraced, because she never judges anyone in her best incarnations, in the most incarnations, in the TV show, the movies, she never judges anyone for anything other than their morality. That's the only thing she'll ever judge you on. So, you know, that's just it's such a wonderful, warm embrace. And all of us queer kids, we picked up on it right away. You know, we got it. We didn't know what we were getting. We didn't understand what we were picking up on yet. But we somehow picked up on it. We knew that was a place for us to be. It was a character for us.
Yeah. Yeah. There was something in that character that went, "Hey, wait, there's something good here."
Do you know there was a TV show in the late 60s? It was supposed to be a Wonder Woman that never got launched. They had a test. I think they showed the pilot on TV. It was, I didn't know about this about maybe 5 years ago. But William Dozier, who did the Adam West Batman TV show, because that was so successful, they did the Green Hornet, you know, for a year. Bruce Lee was in it. But they had a Wonder Woman. There's a pilot. You can probably find it on YouTube. If I can find it, I'll have it on the blog. But you talk about Marston wouldn't like Frank Miller's version. He absolutely would have rolled in his grave at the Wonder Woman. Because what the premise was, where she lived in an apartment with her mother. And her mother would not get off her case that she wasn't married. So you'd have her and the Wonder Woman up, "Mom, I don't have time." You know, it was so 60s. But I was glad that...
Like 60s sitcom, har-har, yuck-yuck?
Yeah, and I mean, it was... You know, a lot of times you hear about some Star Trek episode or something you wish you would have got made that never did or something. This is one that you're thinking, well, I'm glad that we missed that one. It's...
Yeah.
You can see sections of it. I'll try to find it again.
You know, that reminds me of... So there was something that happened is that and it was in the book that you mentioned, The Secret History of Wonder Woman. For a very long time, we as in all of comics historians believe that Marston wrote the last 12 issues of Wonder Woman on his run on his deathbed. Yeah. And the author of that book discovered that was not the truth, that he did not write those on his deathbed. Instead, it was one of Harry G. Peter's typists named Joy Hummel, who was the first woman to write Wonder Woman. And she chose the same pen name as Marston so that the readers wouldn't lose faith in the direction of the comic. So she was the only Golden Age woman writer for the comic, and she said that if Marston had seen what became of it after she stopped writing and they handed it off to another man, if Marston had seen that he would have thrown up, that he just would not have wanted anything to do with that.
Yes.
So as soon as the character was taken away from the family that had brought her to life, almost immediately she was just completely transformed into something she was never meant to be.
Yeah.
Yes.
So well, that's why that's right. Yeah.
Let's talk about those for a minute. That's Robert Kraniger is the artist, I mean the writer that took over. And those stories, again, my friend I worked with that loved Wonder Woman, she had some reprints in paperback books. And she'd just be howling at them, laughing, showing them to me. But he turned them into romance comics. And it had Wonder Woman
basically
taking care of some fight, you know, some battle. And all she's thinking was, I'll be glad when it's over so I can take my rightful place next to my man and support him. And the covers is basically, you know, Steve Trevor handing Wonder Woman flowers. And all they needed was little hearts by their heads. Basically, he had people writing the strip and it had no idea what the character was about. I will say, though, the artist after H.G. Peters, I really liked Ross Andrew. I loved his Wonder Woman work. But yeah, those stories when Marston left, those aren't so good.
So let me ask, what are the Wonder Woman storylines that y'all really like? What are the best ones for you?
John?
John, what do you think?
I don't have the scope you've got. I just read some reprints, and I basically mentioned the ones I love
well,
most.
I appreciate that.
Villainy Inc. and The Origins.
I think that the one that really gets to me is probably the arc with the Baroness, which comes really early. The Baroness is only the second major villain in the comics. But it really struck me in that it was a comic about a woman fighting a woman over the trafficking of women.
Yes.
And it really decentered, because the Baroness is a woman who is abducting women and forcing them to work as intellectual labor, as like typists and like a radio men for the Nazis in the United States. And so the whole idea is that being a woman is so powerful that it requires morality to guide it, that women can, that the woman's power is so absolute that there's you have to, it's not that being a woman is inherently good. There's no inherent goodness in being a woman. You can be a very powerful and evil woman, and that good women are needed to step up and fight for the people who don't have the opportunity to fight for themselves. So I think that one I think is unusual in Marston's run for how it still matters in the modern day, because trafficking of women has not stopped being an issue by any means. There are certain comics where it becomes really outdated, like I love it to death, but there's one where Wonder Woman goes to the planet Mars to fight the god Mars, like that.
Yeah,
you know, like that's a little, it's not my favorite, but I, you know, it's cute, I get it. There's one where she stops a Nazi plan to steal milk from babies. Because babies are getting the milk rations, and then they're going to take the milk. These things are a little less relatable than human trafficking, which is still a huge issue today. So right. I feel like that comic in particular has really stood the test of time.
Those are good ones. I glanced over those later in life. I've read some of those. I will say one storylines, but I liked it whenever they had to fight underwater.
Absolutely.
And the water was shades of green. And I don't know why, it just, they'd make beautiful posters. And you know, his artwork and how Wonder Woman swim through it and fight other women, other men, creatures. I didn't follow him. Like I said, I got these haphazardly through reprints over the years. And I remember the stuff you're talking about, but I remember, wasn't the milk with the babies, with the Nazis, wasn't Hitler chewing carpet on that one at the end? He was so upset because she thwarted him. Hitler was drawn in the thing. I just, whenever I could pick these up, I would read them, but I didn't really have any. They were all great. I guess really my favorite one would be an origin story, because it told about Hercules and how the Amazons won their freedom, and then Hercules tricked them. It started just in a couple panels telling about how women were looked at in the ancient world. And they had one panel where the guy had three women on a chain, and another guy was carrying a goat. And they said, I've got three women. Would you be interested in a trade? He goes, bah, women. I'd rather have my goat. There was something wrong with that guy. But nevertheless, and then when Hercules tricked them and they had the chains, and basically they asked Hera for help, and Hera came back and she said, I helped you before and you ignored it. He says, I'll help you again, but you have to vow you'll never remove your bonds. And, you know, they had Paradise Island, and then again, Wonder Woman and Clay, which freaked me out. But that one, it reverberates with me. That I have to say, was my favorite storyline. It was rich. And, you know, another one I love was when George Perez did Wonder Woman in the mid-80s. That's one of my favorite pieces. All the way through his run, I absolutely loved it. I love the characters that came into it. They even told about Hercules, you know, how he was trapped after that, and, you know, how Queen Hippolyta had to make a decision. I loved all those. And Rook and I talked to Rook endlessly about the new 52 Wonder Woman, the beginning, when, I can't remember his name now, the artist I really like, I'll have it on the blog, but that run, I really enjoyed with her. And I liked the Ross Andrews stories in the late 50s and early 60s. I thought those were wonderful. But the H.G. Peters Moulton stuff, to me, is there's something special to see.
Yeah, I still feel like it's genuinely great American literature. Like, it should be up there with some of the, like, the really classics. It should be regular reading in high schools. And if I can loop back to Harry G. Peter, at one point you brought up the fact that he's a lot of times considered to be a hired gun. But the thing that we have to remember about Harry G. Peter is that he met the Marstons through activism. Harry G. Yes. Peter was an active feminist activist, a suffragette. Yeah. Him and his wife were out at the rallies with the picket signs, you know, chanting and trying to get things done. His greatest collaborator was his wife, Adonica Fulton. His office was run by fellow artist Majorie Wilkes Huntley. Helen Sheppens was his colorist. Margaret Roten was his letterer. And some of his lettering was done by his daughter-in-law, Louise Marston. I could not determine if she was related to the other Marstons. But he took this job not for the money. He didn't need the money. His studio was doing phenomenally with its illustrations, professional illustrations for magazines. He didn't need the money at all. He did it because he believed in the project and believed in the cause. So he may not have had that much to contribute to the storytelling, because his specialty wasn't storytelling. He was an illustrator, right? Originally, yes. His most exceptional work was in illustrating complex concepts in print advertisements or in magazines that needed to convey some sort of idea going along with their article. A lot of times it was abstract, perspective based maps and diagrams of items that hadn't been manufactured yet and that they were still making. So he was an illustrator first and foremost, and his decision to become a cartoonist, he'd worked on cartoons before, but they're more like three panel like strips, right? This was his first real like comic book for kids, 20 pages stapled and bound.
Yeah.
And so him taking on that project so late in his life was truly a labor of passion. He really truly believed in the cause, and that's why when the writers that he believed in, first Marston and then Joy Hummel, when they were no longer on the project, that's why he stepped away from the project, because he wasn't just going to take marching orders from someone who didn't really understand the characters she was meant to be portraying.
Right.
So he never needed the money. He really did it for the love of Wonder Woman. That's what he wanted to do with his life.
You know, one thing we talked about in this thing was the bondage. And I hear all the time people criticizing and laughing about it, saying DC Comics had a woman, her full-time job was to look at the comics and write Marston saying, you're going too far, you have to stop this. Again, Wonder Woman was tied up quite a bit, chained, tied up, gagged. One strip even had her tied up, gagged. She had bandages over eyes and thrown in the water, that beautiful green water that they did with the H.G. Peters stuff. But everybody made fun of it, that was S&M of bondage. But Marston, whenever that criticism would come up, was saying that they were trying to show how she was overcoming obstacles. You're trying to tie you down and you're coming out.
Yeah, it's metaphorical.
Well, metaphorical, but I think he liked that kind of stuff anyway, and that tends to come out.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. But, you know, like I'm saying, I was a kid and I would see these things. Superman was tied in chains. Batman was tied to a torpedo, chained to a torpedo. I mean, she wasn't the only one, but
some controversy arose over the idea that Marston did not hide the fact that he was very open about what his lifestyle was. So people felt they had the right to criticize his personal life in seeing what his work was, which, yeah, it comes through. But in all honesty, he wrote a great comic book. He created a great character. You know, I had no idea about Marston's personal life until Bijan actually mentioned it last time we were talking.
Yeah.
And I started looking into it, and I was like, oh, wow, this guy, like, he was way ahead of his time.
Yeah, he was unique.
Yeah.
You know, the work, after the Wortham hearings, superhero comics, just after World War II, superhero comics are kind of waning. And then after the Wortham hearings, all horror comics, crime comics, horror comics, the Comics Code came into being, and they restricted a lot of that stuff. The crime comics disappeared. Horror comics kind of turned into Twilight Zone kind of thriller stories or big monster stories. And DC basically ceased publication of all their superheroes except Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. Superman and Batman were major sellers. Everybody thought Wonder Woman was, but she wasn't. And one big thing they always said was Wonder Woman was written for girls, but actually most of the people reading her stories were boys. My mom knew some of the stories, but they kept Wonder Woman in print because they had an agreement with the Marston estate that if DC Comics stopped publishing it, it would revert to them. So they kept her around. I don't think that's the thing now. They must own her outright. But Wonder Woman has never ceased publication since she first came on.
She's always been published?
Always. Always.
Really?
It's like The Watchmen. Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons had that deal with Watchmen that once the publication ceased, it would revert back to them. Well, the same thing with the Marston estate. Or with Marston, which now is the estate. But like I said, she wasn't I don't know the numbers on it. I'm told that she wasn't as big of a seller as a lot of the other superheroes. Because, you know, they had Green Lantern, they had The Flash, they had Hawkman, they had Dr. Fate, a bunch of these comics. And they all went away. By this time, DC was printing dog stories. You know, Ace the Wonder Dog, the Bat Dog, Crypto, Lassie. You know, a bunch of Rin Tin Tin. They were trying, you know, romance comics were out. They were trying different things, but Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman were the sole superheroes until, what was it, 1956, when Showcase had the Barry Allen Flash, you know, and that's when Julius Schwartz brought them back as science heroes. But yeah, Wonder Woman's always been in print since she started.
Huh. I had no idea that she had always been in print, but it makes sense when you say that her rights revert back to the family if she's ever not.
Now, I don't know if DC's changed something since, if they bought them outright for them, but that was the case in the 50s. And, but, you know, as Bijan said at the beginning, she is the most recognizable female hero in the world.
Oh, yeah.
You know, everybody knows Wonder Woman. I mean, she's part of the zeitgeist. I mean, she's permeated society all the way through. I don't think you could ever get rid of her, you know, and thank God for that.
Yeah.
You know, I think if you went out and you did a study, if you did a scientific study on different characters from science fiction and fantasy who have been portrayed by women by people in drag, I think Wonder Woman would come out on top of that list. I think there have been more drag performances as Diana Prince than any other science fiction or fantasy character.
Yeah.
I think a hard two might be Dorothy from Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, that makes sense. But, you know, where I worked at Halloween, a lot of people dressed up for work in Halloween. And Wonder Woman, there were always several women that dressed as Wonder Woman. She's always been popular for people to dress up, whether they're men or women. The men are kind of funny, though.
you know, Bijan makes a good point, because as someone who regularly attended drag shows, burlesque shows and things, yeah, you couldn't go any amount of significant time without seeing somebody in a Wonder Woman outfit.
Yeah, yeah.
She's
everywhere.
Well, can y'all believe it's almost the end of the episode already here?
Yeah, this has gone fast. I was really looking forward to this, and when we went off mic, I said, why did we keep recording? So I'm glad this has happened, and I hope this isn't the last time. John, very interesting. You're fantastic. You know,
thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I will come back anytime you want to have me.
Well, before we let you go, I have to ask, is there any, like, truly interesting Wonder Woman history, little trivia note that you really want everybody out there to know?
Yes, I really wanted to shout out, she originally had a sidekick named Etta Candy, who was a super athletic but very fat woman who ran a sorority called Beta Lambda. And every time Wonder Woman would get in trouble, she would radio Etta Candy, and she would come in a bunch of graffiti jalopies with her sorority sisters and beat the crap out of Nazis. Sorry.
Really?
Yeah.
So everyone go look up those comics. If not for anything else than for Etta Candy. Oh my God, Etta Candy is a queen. She says, if I had to choose between men and sweets, I'll always choose sweets because sweets never let me down.
Oh my God, I've never seen this character.
And she always said woo woo all the time. And this is one question I asked my mom. Was after Villainy Incorporated. I think if I remember, they turned the women into gorillas. And anyway, they switched them back. And I remember Etta Candy's comment was, woo, woo, I didn't like that. I didn't like candy anymore. And I thought, what was that about? Mom said, oh, she's just being fun. Okay. But yeah, she was a major character. And George Perez brought her back in the 80s. She ended up being Steve Trevor's secretary. And again, she was a strong character, but a lot different than she was in the Golden Age. But yeah, she was fun. Although, as a 10-year-old, I didn't really understand what sorority girls were. I didn't understand what the holiday girls were. And Etta Candy was completely different than anything I ever read in comics. But she was lively, and I did like her.
I love this character. I'm looking at her design, like, with the victory rolls and everything. Yeah. I had no idea this existed.
Yeah, you need to read some old stuff, dude. Golden Age Wonder Woman. They're nice.
Hey, the original Charles Moulton run, including Joyce Hummel's contributions, is available on Comixology in a single collection. I highly recommend it. It's a lot easier to track down than the physical version. So, yeah. You know, it's a really good read.
Oh, this is awesome. I love this. This is why I love episodes like this when we talk the history, because I know I can usually talk storylines and characters and everything, but Wonder Woman is not completely in my wheelhouse other than, like, you know, Justice League and 52 Countdown, things like that. She showed prominently in those. So this is fantastic. Oh, I have so much to read now.
Very nice. Very nice. So,
before we end this.
Yeah. Well, before we end it, just make sure you check out Cobra Olympus. We talked about her in a past episode. I'll have that linked on there too. Highly recommend the story. Bijan has more stuff down the pipe, and it'll also be a link to her music. Anyway, Rook, take us away, buddy.
Everybody, make sure you go check out bunchofdorks.com. Click on that Cyclops. Before I push on to the next part, though, let me just talk about, real quick, our friend Shane Berryhill. His book, JC and the Olympians, got picked up by Band of Bards and is going to be available in your local comic book shop. The order cutoff is going to be very soon from this episode coming out, so make sure you get by your shop right now and find JC and the Olympians. Tell them to order it for you.
Highly recommend it as well. I'm really happy that this happened, because we've had him in the past. We're going to have him in the future. Outstanding project, and I was disappointed when it didn't make it in the past, and it has. And I think
it found a home, and it's going to find a home in your local comic book shop.
Excellent.
But also, you got to go to the website, find all the information we talked about on this show, and so much more. But until next time, everybody,
read
more
comics.